The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 14th of April 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, remember this?
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
Nearly 20 years and three presidents later, the U.S. is poised to declare an unmistakably symbolic date for finally bringing its troops home. Also ahead, our medical correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, on the widespread pausing of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. Are we calculating the risks sensibly? We'll speak to a German politics enthusiast, they exist, about why Germany's impending election is more interesting than it looks. We'll take a leaf through the Latin American newspapers, and our culture editor Chiara Ramella will be here to talk to us about...
Well, I'm Chiara Ramella, Monocle's culture editor, and I'll be talking about this year's Ramadan TV hits from Egypt to Kuwait.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The United States was not the first foreign power to have learned that sending troops into Afghanistan was one thing, getting them back out something else entirely. US President Joe Biden is reportedly set to announce that the latest deadline for a withdrawal of US forces will be the symbolic one of September 11th, 20 years to the day since the Al-Qaeda attacks on America, which occasioned the original dispatch of America's military. I'm joined with more on this by Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin. Scott, cosmetically speaking, this is a big bet, isn't it? You can't invoke a date like September 11th unless you're completely confident that you can get it done by then.
Yes, I mean, it's a big bet with the domestic population in that, you know, folks in the United States may not know that much about the complexity of what is going on in Afghanistan in 2021, but they certainly know about that marker of 9/11. But Andrew, I think it's an equally bigger gamble, perhaps even a greater one in terms of significance, setting yourself this timetable to withdraw all the U.S. troops from Afghanistan with no real clarity on where we are about the attempted political resolution in Afghanistan. You know, that not backdrop, it's actually in the foreground, the attempt to get the Taliban and the Afghan government together to agree a power-sharing arrangement. Doesn't appear we're making a substantial advance on it. And the point is Afghanistan is not a single country. 20 years after the Taliban were forced out of Kabul, it's a fractured country with the Taliban controlling certain areas, the Afghan government controlling the capital, and then other groups controlling other parts of a country which, you know, whether or not the U.S. troops stay, it's those political issues for Afghanistan and the region that I think are of far more importance without, you know, degrading in any way or denigrating the significance of September 11th for the American people.
Well, this, I guess, is the other aspect of this gamble, which is what happens on September the 12th and onwards. Is the Biden administration calculating that even if the Taliban gets even more of Afghanistan back or perhaps reconquers the entire country, that at this point the American public just don't really care anymore?
I think it's not only the question about the American public. I just think you've got to consider it in practical terms. And that is not just the United States, but other countries countries that have been involved in that coalition, mainly with NATO forces, have tried for 20 years to shore up Afghan forces, to create an Afghan political environment, to create a single country, and it just hasn't happened. And, I'm not saying this is the fault of the U.S., the fault of NATO. I think you have to start with the situation on the ground. But the reality is that if your military forces can't bring about or enable or assist in a political solution, you have to ask at the end of the day whether that presence, is productive. The Americans will still be there in terms of providing economic assistance and being involved in humanitarian programs. They'll be there certainly as advisors to the Afghan government on various issues, political issues and logistical issues. It's just that I think you go into a new phase now, which is, without saying that Afghanistan is going to achieve this political resolution, that it's not going to come, as it were, with hard power through U.S. forces or indeed the forces of any other country.
How does the Biden administration, though, address reputational damage that I guess it might suffer should things go horribly, horribly wrong for those Afghans who have attempted to forge a new Afghanistan with the assistance of the United States? It is not hard to imagine that the months and years immediately following the September 11th are going to be extremely rough ones for Afghan Democrats, Afghan women especially, and those people will have a reasonable case that the United States owes them something, won't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. But I think, again, the question is whether or not the American reputation, as you put it, in combination with the practical issues, had already suffered or been dented by the fact that you haven't been able to get that working Afghanistan, at least across the country, in terms of providing for those basic rights, in terms of providing for those basic institutions. I do think, without trying to speculate too much, I think if you had a position where the Taliban not only refused to go into a power-sharing relationship with the government, but let's say if you go into yet another civil war and the Taliban were victorious, given the nature of the system they would probably set up, then I think you would have a huge, reputational damage. What we're talking about is yet another phase in that Afghan civil war that goes all the way back to the 1990s. But at this point, again, having those American troops in place, if you're really saying that that U.S. troops or the troops of other countries are there to prevent the Taliban from going back into Kabul, you're in an open-ended commitment, which isn't just for 10, 20 years after 9/11. It's for 30, 40, 50 years. And Biden, as vice president, already favored pulling back on that commitment. And now that he's president, he's just simply, I think, in a position where, despite the objections of the Pentagon, he can try to put a cap on it.
Scott Lucas, thank you, as always, for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. This is The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Your chances of being struck by lightning in a given year, it says here, are roughly 1 in 500,000. On current form, your chances of developing serious blood clots after receiving the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine are somewhere north of 1 in 1 million. Nevertheless, the US, the EU and South Africa have all temporarily paused their rollouts of the Johnson & Johnson jab. This follows a similar unease about the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has also been paused or restricted in some jurisdictions. Indeed, in news just breaking in the last few minutes, it is reported that Denmark, according to Danish media, is poised to withdraw the AZ vaccine entirely. Well, joining me with more on whether this is arguably too cautious by half is Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Chris is also a consultant virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, first of all, if we look at the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, what do we know for certain about the clot risk?
We think, Andrew, this is roughly on par with what we've seen with AstraZeneca's vaccine. And in fact, I predicted that this may happen about a week or two ago. And the reason for that is that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a modified adenovirus that causes colds generally. And the AstraZeneca vaccine is a modified chimpanzee adenovirus. It causes the chimpanzee equivalent of a human cold, and it's been modified in the same sort of way. So given that these vaccines work similarly, they're structured similarly, it is not entirely unexpected that you would expect to see side effects in common. But these side effects are excruciatingly rare, and the risk for AstraZeneca's vaccine causing you a problem is about 1 in 1 million, similar for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And many are saying that this is a way overcautious overreaction, which actually is throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine clotting cases, I think about 6 of them, have all been reported in women, which is obviously a concern. But is it still not the case that that is by an order of magnitude less risky than the contraceptive pill, which is routinely prescribed?
Yes, the condition that everyone is concerned about is called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. This is because in your head you have a special network of blood vessels that drain blood out of the brain and return it to the general circulation, and those are called venous sinuses. And in a small number of people every year, just by chance, you get coagulation of blood in those structures. In the venous sinuses, you get venous sinus thrombosis. That happens at the rate of about 5 to 15 people per million per year. If you take the oral contraceptive pill, the chance of that happening increases by about 8-fold. So it goes, let's call the numbers 10 for ease. It goes from being about 10 in a million to, say, 100 in a million or 1 in 100,000. Now, that you can immediately see is 10 times more common than the chances of having the same side effect, assuming this is a real finding with these vaccines. So this shows you that it's a disproportionate reaction. Most people are very comfortable to say, well, I'll make a risk-benefit analysis of using the oral contraceptive pill, and I'm comfortable with that risk. On the other hand, they don't seem to be able to use the same constraint and restraint when it comes to making the same risk judgment about these vaccines. And I think it's a misstep.
So if we understand that all of us probably do a dozen things before lunch which carry a greater than 1 in 1 million chance of injuring us, what do you think is actually going on here?
I don't know, because another way of looking at this is to say, well, what's your chance of having a serious car accident? There are about 30 million cars on the roads of the UK. There are roughly 3,000 people killed or maimed on Britain's roads every year. So your chance of having a serious car accident is about 1 in 1,000. I mean, it's 1,000 times more likely than having a consequence or a complication with one of these vaccines. So it I think, is people reacting overcautiously, and I suspect that it's defensive medicine. Now, when we practice medicine these days, what goes through our minds obviously always is the benefit of the patient, but what next goes through your mind is, and what won't get me sued? And I suspect that when you have people envisaging a situation in future where a lawyer would say to them, right, okay, you've got two vaccines you could use. This one we know has this excruciatingly rare side effect, and this one which doesn't. You subjected these people to this one which has this excruciatingly rare side effect, and even though it's excruciatingly rare, it's going to happen to somebody. So you knowingly did that. You're now guilty. You have to pay a fortune in compensation, versus you could use another vaccine which doesn't yet have a side effect we know about. So therefore, you're taking the legally safe route. And I suspect that there's a healthy helping of defensive medicine being practiced here.
The obvious problem with that being, of course, that slowing down the vaccine rollout means, does it not, that more people get sick? Even in Denmark, which is poised apparently to withdraw the AstraZeneca vaccine entirely, is admitting that that will slow down its vaccine program by a matter of weeks, which obviously ends up with X hundred more cases of COVID-19 and doubtless more serious illness and more death.
Yes, it does. And I think that is always the tension when you introduce any kind of treatment. It's on a means tested or needs basis or a cost benefit analysis. There are always winners and losers. And it is very important to keep in mind what the benefit is versus what the loss is. And it's with that in mind that I think regulators in some countries that haven't gone as far as to say, we're just going to ban these vaccines, that's what they've been doing when they've put an age cutoff in place, because they've said there is a compromise to be made. Because if you envisage an age spectrum and we consider an 80-year-old at one end of that age spectrum, an 80-year-old might have a 1 in 10 or higher chance of succumbing to coronavirus infection, but a 1 in a million chance of having a side effect. Whereas an 18-year-old has a 1 in a million chance of succumbing to coronavirus infection, and a 1 in a million chance of succumbing to a complication from the vaccine. So you can see that there's a less compelling case to be made for a younger person than there is for an older person. Rare outcomes all the same, but not zero outcomes. And it's on that basis that regulators like the MHRA here in the UK said, well, we'll set the bound at 29 down to 18, offer an alternative vaccine in the meantime for AstraZeneca, for example, and above that age, go business as usual, because we can see that there's a clear trend in terms of a turning point where the cost-benefit analysis means there is a breakpoint. Other countries, I think, are being much more cautious, saying, well, let's just not use this vaccine, which to me is nuts.
Chris Smith, thank you as ever for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Here is Carlotta Ribello with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. A US court has begun hearing testimony in defense of a former police officer who stands accused of murdering George Floyd. Derek Chauvin, who is white, knelt on the neck of Mr. Floyd, a black man, in May of last year. Mr. Floyd's death led to worldwide protests against racism and policing in the United States. New Zealand is to become the first country in the world to bring in a law which forces its financial firms to report on the effects of climate change. New Zealand's government wants the country to be carbon neutral by 2050 and says the financial sector needs to play its part. It's been announced that the Japanese space company iSpace will transport a United Arab Emirates rover to the moon in 2022. Under the agreement, iSpace has said that it will also provide the Emirates' lunar mission with wired communication and power during the cruise. And Henley & Partners, a firm that describes itself as a leader in helping people obtain citizenship, has released its annual passport index. You can find out about the winners and losers and how it ranks nations' travel documents by heading over to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Carlotta. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Germans will vote in a general election a few months from now, likely on September 26th. It is obviously a consequential event, not least because it will decide who succeeds Angela Merkel as Chancellor. However, it is unlikely that many people outside Germany will be staying up all night, shoveling down the popcorn in an enraptured trance, watching the results come in. A perception exists, it is fair to say, that German politics is staid, sober, and frankly tedious. Given, however, that we're likely to be talking about it a fair bit these next few months, we're quite keen to find a way to be excited about it. Well, joining me now is Tanit Koch, a columnist for The New European and former editor-in-chief at Bild and RTL and German politics enthusiast. Tanit, first let's talk about the perception of German politics as a bit dull. Is it in fact designed to be boring?
I think you're absolutely right, Andrew, but this year has seen less dullness than usual because we've had actually something hardly ever sort of seen for a couple of years now, which is dodgy payments to members of parliament of both the Conservative parties, CDU and CSU, which cost them massively in the polls, and a couple of MPs had to step down. And this has not been seen for a couple of years, though. The last massive scandal involving people in parliament, which is back years ago. So we've and this, of course, had to do also with COVID, because they sort of pocketed money for enabling mask deals. And people are very, very unhappy about it.
Well, that's encouraging, I guess, in its own way. But as I explained in the intro, what we're trying to do here is get our listeners pumped up for our oncoming coverage of the German election. So if you're trying to sell the German election as something that outsiders can buy into, what should they be looking out for?
Well, at the moment, and I'm not sure this will last till September, I'm pretty much expecting a decision this week. But at the moment, you can look out for who's actually going to be the candidate for the Conservatives, like the Crown Prince that wants to be Merkel's heir on the throne. But at the moment, and this is sort of the race we're going to watch until September, the Green Party is about 3 percentage points away from running the chancellery. So we might actually see a green chancellor for the first time ever in Germany in September. But a lot of things may happen until then. But what is happening this week is that CDU and CSU actually have to decide who's going to be run out for the candidacy.
I mean, German politics has obviously been dominated for a long time by probably the only German politician most non-Germans can name, which is, of course, the Chancellor Angela Merkel. Beyond her, however, are there any great characters, whether heroes or villains or something in between, looming in German politics? Somebody that, again, a non-German observer could perhaps identify with or buy into?
So we do not have a Boris Johnson type of political personality.
Congratulations.
Well, some see it that way, some the other. So in terms of sort of entertainment, a Bojo would certainly help German politics being a little less dull, because what you can, I mean, you've mentioned Angela Merkel, and she, I think, for one of the last elections, she ran with the slogan, "You know me," and that's actually a perfect slogan, because people do know her, and she's absolutely free of scandal. But she also lacks sort of the charisma you find in Obama and also Boris Johnson. So she runs things stably, but she's not she's definitely not sort of the entertainment person. So we do not really have that. That's style of politics. I always envy you for prime minister's question time in parliament, because we've tried to set that up in Germany, but it's actually not working the same way it does in Westminster either. But you could look out for who we have now as the sort of two main opponents within the Conservatives, which is Markus Söder, who, at least when he dresses up for carnival, gives a bit of an impression. And his sort of slightly smaller and a bit chubby opponent, Laschet, and both run the two, I'd say, biggest and economically most important states in Germany. And they want to be to Angela Merkel, but at the moment they're sort of a bit at each other's throat in sort of in German terms. And we'll see who wins that race or fight this week.
Tanit Koch, thank you very much for joining us, and hopefully we will be hearing more from you as polling day looms. That was the German political commentator Tanit Koch. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Time now to have a leaf through the Latin American newspapers. And joining me to do exactly that is Monocle 24's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, I believe we are starting in Peru.
We are indeed. And of course, the main story at El Comercio today, we kind of have the results of the first round of the Peruvian presidential elections. I say kind of because it's almost 100% of the vote counted. It would be very hard to be different. And Andrew, I have to say, a lot of surprises in there. The dispute will be between Pedro Castillo, a trade unionist, very much a leftist, with 19.1%. And he'll be battling with someone completely the opposite of him. Keiko Fujimori, 13.35%.
A recognizable surname in Peru.
Very recognizable. And
that's recognizable in inverted commas.
Yes, the daughter of Alberto Fujimori, of course, who is in jail. She's been in jail herself.
Yeah, but how many former Peruvian presidents aren't?
Exactly. And in a way, Andrew, I think Pedro Castillo surprised everyone, because even the Peruvian political commentators, they were not expecting him to go to the second round. But as you rightly said, many Peruvian prime ministers have been accused of corruption. There's been a lot of kind of turmoil in the country. And he came as this anti-corruption figure. So it's going to be an interesting battle. But as I said, he's very much to the far left. But again, if you're a centrist in Peru, it's going to be a very hard choice for you.
Moving on to Brazil, one of your home country newspapers, reporting that there's going to be fewer of you.
Absolutely. A remarkable story from O Globo today. Basically, basically, and in March this year, 8 states in Brazil had more deaths than births. And it's interesting because, just to compare, this March 2021, 13 births for 10 deaths overall in the whole country. Just the year before was 22 births for 10 deaths. So we are shrinking very, very fast. Scientists were saying that this would happen in Brazil in 2047. I very much doubt that we have to wait that long. And the reasons, of course, the COVID deaths has a role in that. But not only. People are having less babies. And I wonder if people want to have babies during the middle of a pandemic as well. But it's a very rapidly shrinking population that is happening in Brazil at the moment.
Moving along finally to the United States, you have a cinema story you wanted to talk about.
From the Los Angeles Times, something that I am personally quite sad. The ArcLight Cinemas, mainly in the region of California, they are closing, which is very sad news because they have iconic cinemas in the city, including the Cinerama Dome, that iconic kind of cinema that is built like a dome. Quentin Tarantino had the premiere of his last film over there as well. I've been to one of the ArcLight cinemas. It's a very pleasant experience, I have to say, Andrew. It's a really... I know you're not perhaps a big fan of going to the cinema. ArcLight is good.
Is this a pandemic thing? No, obviously the cinema business model of let's get large crowds of people together in a dark room for hours has not been, it's not been conducive.
I think it's a little bit of the pandemic, but they had problems even before the pandemic. But I wonder if, you know, in a few months' time, someone is going to buy, because they are iconic kind of buildings in Los Angeles as well. It would be very much a big loss for the city if they go.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us, our senior correspondent there. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. And finally, on today's show, Ramadan Mubarak, to any listeners who do begin observing Ramadan today. This is an important time across the Arab world, of course, but not least for the broadcasters of those countries. The post-iftar schedule, when families settle down for an evening's viewing after breaking their fast, is extremely valuable airtime. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella. This is one of those things, Chiara, that when you think about it, you think, well, yes, of course it is. It's family time. Everybody, after fasting all day, has had a nice big feed, so everybody now wants to watch something. So this is huge business.
It is indeed. It's very interesting to note that, obviously, this has been the case for a long time for broadcasters across the Arab region, but that now, I guess, with the introduction of more and more streaming services, obviously the streaming services are jumping on the broadcasting trend as well. So you're looking at services like View, for example, launching 9 series during Ramadan, because, as you say, it's perfect prime time. You know, people are all together. They want to unwind with their family. And interestingly, historically, the format has often been that the TV series that aired during Ramadan would be formed of 30 episodes, so one per night. See, it really is, you know, really capturing your attention for that time.
They invented box set binging.
Pretty much, yes. And also, interestingly, obviously, this is, you know, a time when ratings really skyrocket, and so it's very appealing for advertisers as well. So if you go, you know, if you drive down the streets in Cairo, you'll see these massive billboards, you know, a little bit like Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, with all these massive...
From personal experience, I would say if you're driving down the road in Cairo, what you're actually fixing your eyes on is the roads ahead with absolute bug-eyed terror.
Yeah, I have heard that Cairo traffic is not quite to be underestimated. But yes, you know, it's big business, and clearly a lot of different players are trying to get their share of it. And there are heaps and heaps of series coming out. Interestingly, also, they really do span all sorts of genres. You've got your kind of tearjerker, kind of telenovelas, as well as really quite intense kind of high-octane thrillers at the same time. And again, you know, despite this being during Ramadan, the subjects of the series go well beyond kind of religious themes, and they are just an occasion to get people together and to get them really addicted to a series, basically.
So what are some things that are going to be big?
Well, having done my research, I do think that people are really looking forward to the second season of Al Ekhtiyar, which translates to The Choice. It's going to be a big series talking about kind of police officers. It's a big kind of thrillery police drama. And then we do have a clip for you from Hagba Mortada, which is another thriller. It sounds pretty intense.
Let's hear it.
Maybe Jamfani.
سيف العربي قوته ثقته في نفسه
انا ما انهزمتش سيف ابتدى يتعافى من التجربه ويفتح لنفسه صفحه جديده
هو اني في
جيمو
انت كويس يا سيف حدش يقدر ينكر ده
See, my Arabic is less than it might be, but that does not sound like a light romantic comedy.
It isn't, no. And I've got to tell you, I did study Arabic for a year, and my teacher was Egyptian, so I should be able to pick up on the accent. But it was a few years ago, and I really have dropped the ball. But yeah, it's a story about the Egyptian intelligence service, and I guess, like, trying to understand the powers that be that may have moved the revolution. So it sounds really quite intriguing.
Just finally, then, is there any lighter viewing for those of us who might enjoy a bit of a chuckle?
Well, there is. I think I was looking at this. Well, actually, a lot of it is kind of family drama that does have a bit of a kind of tragedy element to it. I was going to mention this. I was going to mention this family drama from Kuwait. But it is about an older sister has to step up to kind of lead her family upon the death of her mother. So that's not quite the light-hearted viewing that you were after. I did find a series called Dar al-Kasra that's also tipped to be quite big. It is about a food blogger, but then there is a twist. She does witness a murder. So actually, in fact, it does actually sound a little bit
That sounds amazing. It's like somebody pitched a series about a food blogger and somebody realized at the last minute, God, no, that'll be terrible. We need a murder.
Yes, exactly. Let's just twist it. If you do watch the trailer, it does sound a little bit like that too. There is a twist.
Excellent. Chiara Ramella, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our studio manager was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, midday London. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.